Well, hello there, and welcome to this Radio Free Nintendo thing. We're on episode 212. I got a reduced group here with us this week. First up, James Jones.
Hello.
Next up, Greg Lay.
Well, howdy there, Johnny.
Yeah, and that, wow. and that's me, Johnny. Unfortunately, John Lindemann could not be here with us today. He had some last-minute travel, and we wish him Godspeed on that. So we are going to jump into some new business and then catch up on a bunch of listener mail after that. So I'll kick it off. I played a good bit of Dragon Quest IX this week. It's like the first time in a month, probably, that I've played it at all. It's interesting. One of the reasons I put it down before is because this game, Dragon Quest, just the side quests in 9 feel even more open-ended than in the other ones. I mean, you can spend hours just walking around picking up alchemy shit so that you can make some obscure piece of armor and save yourself a few gold from having to buy it in a shop. And the reason that you kind of have to do that is the stuff in the shop is so expensive. I mean, you can't afford any of it. It's just, yeah, I'll go beat a couple of bosses and run around and grind, and I can buy like a shield, you know. And when I run into a situation, which I did this week, where I'm up against a boss that I can't beat, like I actually started moving the story forward because I just felt like I was getting mired in like, you know, ADD side quests hell. And so I was like, okay, I want to play some Dragon Quest and I want to actually like move towards the end of it a little bit. And I did that and I did some interesting stuff. I rode a dragon. I went to prison. I broke out of prison. But now I'm trying to beat this boss and dude, I mean, he just murderized me the first time I beat him. I was like, okay, I probably need to upgrade my armor. But unfortunately doing that, it's like a 5-hour process because this shit's so expensive and you can alchemize it. But alchemizing it is a long process too, because you have to pick up all these like base ingredients to make all this stuff. So it's just really complex either way. I mean, I'd rather alchemize it because it's more interesting. The other choice is to basically grind for a couple hours and make a ton of money that way. And that's, you know, it's boring. It's not as much fun. So I think I'm getting to the point now where I can probably move forward again. But, yeah, that game's awesome, but it goes on forever. James, again, James's choice in RPGs really befuddles me. He plays all these shitty Tales games, and he leaves things like Dragon Quest IX on the table.
I'm not even going to argue. I will say, though, that you've almost certainly crossed the Last Remnant line now.
Like the Mendoza line.
Of sheer mentions, I think we've crossed the line now.
Of sheer mentions? Sure.
I mean, yes.
The reason that I'm okay with mentioning it again is that I think a lot of people listening are probably still playing Dragon Quest IX. The nature of the game is it's just very hard to blow through quickly. But it does have one of those nice features where you can like basically push the Y button and it'll bring up the story so far and it'll kind of tell you what you need to go do next. So it's nice if you set it down for a few weeks and then pick it back up. You know, you can pretty quickly just jump back into it and know what you're supposed to do. But moving on, obviously, we've talked plenty about Dragon Quest IX, so I got a really surprising package in the mail this week from...
Shoes.
No, thank God it wasn't shoes. More on that later. No, I got a very surprising package from Mike Gammon, who is Pale Zero. He's our shipping dude on staff. And I was like, why is he sending me a package? And I open it up, and it's Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions for the DS. I'm like... oh, that's nice. Why am I getting this? You know, I mean, I haven't written a review in 2 years, so I don't get free games anymore. And so I was like, did Pale have temporary insanity? What's going on here? So I emailed him. It turns out we just got an extra copy and they were, you know, I guess they were asking around, you know, who should get this. And I guess Neil put in the word that, hey, you should send it to Johnny because, you know, he'll talk about it on the podcast and he likes those games. And he is correct on both accounts. I haven't had much time to jump into it yet, but, I do really, really, really like what I've played so far. Excellent first impression on this game. It's from the same team, Griptonite Games, who made Web of Shadows for DS, which is that Metroidvania Spider-Man game. It's like combining three things that I love so much. And it's all portable. You know, it's a very, very fast action game. The exploration is not super deep. This is more Other M than Zero Mission, I guess I would say. It's not even as complex as Other M, really. But
nah, I don't think so.
But, yeah, I mean, the Metroid elements are subdued, Let's put it that way. It's not Super Metroid-y. It's really not Castlevania-y at all.
I suppose the main thing I would think of it being sort of similar-ish maybe to an explorative Castlevania game is the kind of RPG-ish sort of character building that you've got there.
Well, you do rack up a lot of upgrades that will basically give you extra health or make your attack stronger. But there's no experience in this game. I think there might have been in Web of Shadows. I think like you build up points as you kill guys and you can buy new moves with it. But
you spent the points, yeah.
Right, that's not in this one. So this feels a little more straightforward. It's basically an action game with just kind of larger environments. You know, you don't necessarily just run from left to right. So the platforming is very similar though to the last game, and it just feels so good. I mean, just this developer, I think more than any of the console Spider-Mans that I've ever played, I think this handheld developer really gets a feel for how Spider-Man should feel when you push the buttons for the speed that he moves through the rooms, for the animation and the way that moves flow together. It just feels really good, and because it's a 2D game on the DS, I think it's much easier for this developer to concentrate on the platforming and the level designs. Whereas in a console game, because it's in 3D, it tends to be more kind of open and the environments just aren't as closed in. And so it's harder to make good use of things like wall crawling. I mean, when you're outside in the city and it's just a bunch of buildings, wall crawling's not that interesting. But when you're inside of a building or you're underground and you're going through the sewers and you have all these surfaces that are very close to you, then wall crawling becomes a lot more integral to the way that you move around the environment. It just feels really good. I like this a lot. I also think it looks excellent. It definitely looks better than their last game. And I think back to, do you remember that Spider-Man game that was like a DS launch title?
No.
Well, I didn't play it, but I remember.
Yeah, I reviewed it. It certainly looked great. It was a Vicarious Visions game, and they made an excellent GBA Spider-Man game called Mysterio's Menace that is still one of the best Spider-Man games I've ever played. This one actually feels quite a bit like it. But yeah, that first Spider-Man game on DS was a mess. I mean, just design-wise, it was terrible. But it looked great at the time. It was a really impressive graphically game. I bet if I went back and looked at that game now, I'd think it looked really shitty. I think they've probably come a long way. It's a different developer now, but I mean, 6 years later.
It's a long time in video games.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the character is much smaller now, but the way it animates so fluidly and it's so clean looking, it's just really nice. So yeah, I've only played it for like 45 minutes. It's not a long game, but still.
Have you got any sense of the whole, like, because I guess the big difference between the two Web of Shadows and this one is the three different Spider-Men.
Right.
Is there any sense of how much that contributes or not?
Well, I think I think the differences are much less significant on the DS game than they are in the consoles. Because
right.
on the DS game, they basically all feel the same. They seem to have the same combat moves. There's like a point in the story where the different abilities that you've been collecting with them basically merge and they can all share the same abilities. I'm not quite there yet, but they've been talking about it, so it's coming up. So there's basically no stealth gameplay for Noir. There's no skydiving stuff for $20.99. These things just don't work as well in the handheld 2D type of design. But the interesting thing is, you know, you start out in Amazing, and then you go to Noir, and I've played through that. And when you get into Noir, it says Spider-Man Noir doesn't have wall crawling yet. Once you open up the sharing, he'll be able to get that from Amazing, I guess. But he can still use his web lines. And so navigating that part of the game feels very different because now you can't stick to the walls. You have to rely a lot more on your zip lines and things like that. And wall jumping, actually. Like very, very Metroid-y in that sense. And then when you get to 2099, which I just got to, he has wall crawling but no web yet. Which also changes the way you do combat because you can use web in combat. But now again, navigating the environment becomes very different because he has to rely on wall crawling and his glide ability he can sort of fly for very short distances, and you can steer that up and down as well. So I really like that. I mean, definitely so far the three different characters feel very different because of these restrictions they put on them, and it makes you kind of rely more on other abilities that you might not use as much. But the problem is, very soon, those restrictions are going to go away, and I'm worried that they're all going to feel exactly the same once that happens, which would be kind of a shame. Mm. that would be kind of a loss. But we'll see. They might make up for it in other ways. I'm still very early in the game.
Is that how in future we might see Samus lose her abilities, do you think, rather than the poorly received authorization, just parallel world Samus?
I'd be fine with that. I mean, they you know, you sort of had that in Echoes, where it wasn't losing abilities, but when you go into the Dark World in Echoes, now she can't just run around like she could before. You're tied to these beacons, and I actually really like that mechanic, because it forces you to play very differently and think about how you move through the environments in a different way. And I think I've said this before, but, you know, basically once you get the dark armor and the light armor, that element goes away, and the Dark World now becomes basically the same as the light world. And it just, you know, it's kind of disappointing for me, because it takes away one of the most interesting things about the game. They call it an upgrade. I would call it, you know, you're kind of taking away the thing that I really liked about this game. So you have to be careful with things like that. If you're gonna restrict the player in a certain way, maybe you should stick with it through the end. You know, maybe you should keep thinking up ways to use that all the way through.
I'm thinking maybe that they would just restrict it to areas you'd already been in. Like, you know, if you're backtracking, I can understand not wanting to restrict the movement.
Sure.
But if you're going through it that first sort of time where it's going to be more guided, then they might have kept the sort of peril, but they didn't. I think it was just they were too afraid of people getting really annoyed, because certainly some people did.
Yeah. Well, again, it's the same thing I said about Twilight Princess. You know, I really like the wolf stuff, and unfortunately, pretty early in the game, you kind of clear out enough of the Twilight that you don't have to be the wolf anymore. And that's too bad. You know, that was the most that was basically the gimmick of that game. And I felt like it ended up being really underutilized, because the way the story is paced out, you just kind of don't have to be the wolf after a while. It's too bad. So anyway, moving on, I also this past week bought and played the first significant DLC that I can ever think of, other than like Rock Band songs, which aren't really significantly different from the standard songs. I downloaded the Lair of the Shadow Broker DLC for Mass Effect 2. James, you played quite a bit of Mass Effect 2, didn't you, earlier this year?
Well, I beat it.
Yeah. Have you been tempted by any of the DLC packs?
Not really. It's just, I felt like a lot of them were priced pretty high.
Yeah, I agree completely. This is the third one that they've done. They've done some like weapon packs, but those are neither here nor there. This is the third story chunk of DLC that they put out. And the first two didn't get really great reviews, and so I was like, okay, never mind. This one, Lair of the Shadow Broker, got very good reviews. I heard some really strong things about it on some other podcasts. I read some positive things about it, and I kind of thought, you know, I was going to buy some points anyway to pick up Res HD on James's recommendation, and I enjoyed that quite a bit. But I thought, you know, I love Mass Effect 2 so much. I mean, I've said before, it's probably one of my favorite games ever. And if this DLC is really good and it's up to the quality of the main game, then I should give it a shot. And so I bid it. It's $10, and it's a little short. It's about 2 hours long, probably. So I don't know that it's a great value, but definitely the content that they add is very high quality and very interesting and a lot of fun to play through. So I don't regret it at all. I'm not disappointed by it at all. And it does provide a really quirky, like, new location. You know, not a new city, but like a new place that you can go to afterward, and you can keep going back to it whenever you want. And it doesn't really have new side missions in there, but it has like a lot of information that you can't get otherwise, because it's the Lair of the Shadow Broker. So it's like, you know, this guy basically deals information about everybody. And so it has this really weird Peeping Tom aspect to it, oddly enough. Because once you beat the DLC, you get access to this lair, and it has this, there's like this computer console with, it's just called Dossiers. You go in there and you can read like hacked emails of all the people on your ship. So you can read like Miranda Lawson, she's this one of the main characters in the game. You can read all these private emails where she joined an interstellar dating service, and you can read all these email exchanges with like potential dates that she had been set up with. And those are basically jokes. But then you can also read this really interesting, like, half joke, half dramatic conversation between her and her sister, who's part of the story earlier in the game. And then you go into some of the other characters. Some of them are really serious. It's like, you know, basically just background codex type stuff on all these characters, but it's weird to read it because this is a very private exchanges and things like that, and it's just the way the Shadow Broker works is he steals your info, you know, he basically spies on people, and now you have access to that. It's very interesting stuff. It was weird. It was like a curveball. It wasn't what I was expecting, but yeah, so I ended up playing several hours of Mass Effect 2, not just the DLC, but started basically finding a bunch of side missions that I don't know if they've been added for free since the last time I played it or if I just somehow missed them the first time, but I ended up doing a lot of little things, and the attention to detail in that game, the amount of content that they've packed in is absurd, because you'll be just digging around all these planets, basically no-name planets, you know, it's just kind of bullshitty extra content, and all of a sudden you find a new place to land, and you go down there, and it's like this little micro level that you walk around in. There might be a few enemies to shoot, there might not be, but you kind of walk around, you find some resources, you find some money, you get a little bit of story, and a lot of times those will lead to other micro missions on other planets, and some of these will, will go for like 3 or 4 deep of these little missions, and they're not hard, they don't last very long, but that stuff, I mean, this game would have been fine without that. It's just amazing to me that someone actually sat down and made these, and they made unique environments for them, unique dialogue, unique text, all of this stuff to put in there, and most players will probably never find it. I mean, it's really tucked away. It's very hard to find, so that game just, it blows my mind, the level of detail that's in that game. Before I hand it over to James here, I do have one note. We've had many minutes of discussing James's Xbox tales of woe, Red Ring, crap like that. I didn't have a Red Ring, but my brand new 6-week-old Xbox Slim
oh god,
started acting really weird a few days ago. I don't know if you guys have heard this, but it has like this touch-sensitive button to open the drive, and when you pass your finger over it, it goes bing, and that's the sound of the drive opening or closing. Well, it started doing that on its own randomly in the middle of the night.
Good.
When the system is off.
You know what that's called? That's called the betrayal of your previous Xbox.
the poltergeist activity.
Yeah, it's very like possessed feeling. It's a little unsettling because sometimes I'll just be sitting there like eating dinner or something, and all of a sudden the dish tray opens up.
Feed me.
Yeah, there have been a lot of times when I turn the system off at night, I go to bed, I get up in the morning, it's on because the dish drive has opened and then shut again, which will cause the system to turn on. And it's just been sitting there for who knows how many hours, just baking in its own heat for no reason.
Doing its own juices.
I mean, you know, being an engineer, I tested a lot of possible causes of this and couldn't find any kind of consistent pattern. I think it's just fucked. I think the sensor or whatever that opens and closes that drive is just totally fucked.
Well, it's not a mechanical opening command. It's electronic, so it's probably the button that corresponds to the input.
Some kind of electrical signal thing. And so anyway, the thing's fucked. I called Microsoft, and luckily, you know, it's still under warranty. I just have to mail it in. They're going to repair it. I'll be without an Xbox for 2 or 3 weeks, but that's fine. I have plenty of games. It did make me wonder why the hell, when they're redesigning the system anyway, why didn't they switch to just a slot? Like everything else. I mean, what possible advantage is there to having a mechanical disk drive tray that has to open and close? I don't get it. That's annoying. I mean, that's a brand new system and it's already broken. I have to send it in and get it fixed. Bad. So I'm a little pissed about that.
Is this the part where I remind you my Super Famicom still works?
Yeah. Well, your Super Famicom doesn't have a mechanical disk drive tray, does
it? It's barely got any movie parts in it at all.
Exactly. That's what Nintendo is very good about. That's how things should be. Anyway, that's a lot of crap from me. James, please take it away.
So, I've been primarily playing a singular game as I try to cut through this pile of great values / horrible backlogs that I found.
Great values?
Well, I mean, it's hard because you get like a 3 games the price of 2 deal,
yeah.
And then that causes a 3-game backlog immediately.
Right, right.
And then you get something like what I found, which is a 2-pack. So apparently, when Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts went to Platinum Hits for the 360, they actually released a bundle of it with Viva Pinata that had hit a long time previous because that game's much older.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a disc jacket, basically, that has two covers on it that when you open it up, it's got the double disc thing, and one is Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts, and the other is Viva Pinata.
And both of those games were kind of budget priced to begin with, even when they first were launched.
This two-pack was $2 more used than buying just Nuts and Bolts used. Which at this point, I'm like, well, damn.
Well, how much did you spend for this two-pack?
I think $16.
Wow. Two games, two Xbox 360 games for $16.
Two rare Xbox 360 games for that, which I haven't checked in with our friends at Rare since their departure from Nintendo systems. So, you know, I...
Few have, James.
No grab by the ghoulies.
I'm getting to that, Greg.
It's quality time.
I remember the catastrophic failure of Grab by the Ghoulies.
Yeah.
Which starts with its title and then proceeds down through every element of the game.
Well, and they did that remake of Conker for the first Xbox,
right.
And that was
weird.
I never heard very many good things about that. I mean, it was more censored than the N64 version. What the hell?
So really, their time on the Xbox was shady at best.
Yeah.
Which isn't surprising, since it takes them about 37 years to make a game. Their time on the 360 started out pretty shaky. I mean, they had Cameo finally came out.
Mm-hmm. And Perfect Dark Zero.
And Perfect
Ouch.
Dark Zero. Neither of which were greatly received. Cameo was, what, 18 years in development?
I definitely played that game on GameCube
a couple of years.
Let me
put it to you this way. I have a launch GameCube. I still have my box for it in a closet. On the back of that box is a picture of Cameo Elements of Power as an upcoming title for the game,
yep.
For the system.
Yep.
So, fuck all. But I had never played a demo of Nuts and Bolts, and I had played a little bit of Viva Pinata, which Viva Pinata is kind of a morbid title, and I guess that's probably what I'll talk about next week. But I decided to focus my attention on Nuts and Bolts since, you know, I just blasted through Banjo-Tooie,
mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, let's see what happened.
8 years later.
It's 8 years later. There's no powers anymore. And basically, you're forced to build shit.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm an engineer, essentially. I mean, engineering on the end of software, but that's why I got into this field. I enjoy engineering things, problem solving, experimenting, finding solutions to things,
mm-hmm.
Combining stuff to make better stuff. So, to me, this was like, well, damn, this is the perfect game, which is then why I didn't proceed to buy it for the 2 years I've had an Xbox. But
if there's one thing I know about you, James, is that you don't buy the games that you would like.
Yeah.
Chrome Hounds.
I should have liked Chrome Hounds, to be fair.
If you could have moved faster.
if I could have moved faster than a glacier. What I've found with... So basically, people who don't know what Nuts and Bolts is, because they're deaf, apparently, and blind, so they're not listening very well to this.
Amnesiac?
Possibly. I mean, this could be like a David Lynch kind of thing going on here. Maybe this is their first time ever hearing about video games. I don't know.
If you see me two more times.
But Nuts and Bolts is the third Banjo-Kazooie title. I'll go with third.
Are you saying it's Banjo-Kazooie 3?
Kind of.
What about the one for Game Boy Advance?
Game Boy Advance, Grunty's Revenge.
Yeah, that's kind of why I said kind of. I'm not sure where I want to put Grunty's Revenge.
Yeah.
But this game builds off the story of 2.
The story.
It does. It's set 8 years after they defeated Skeleton Grunty from the second game, who was formerly Witch Grunty of the first game.
Isn't she now like Grunty's head in a jar?
She starts the game as a cracked skull that sort of digs its way out of a rock pile after 8 years, and then proceeds to threaten to bite the ankles of the heroes.
Oh, it's just very, very, very Monty Python then. I was thinking it sounds a bit Python. Oh, it is totally Python.
Oh, yeah, it is. Who have grown rotund in the last 8 years because they've basically been eating pizza all day, every day.
Playing cards.
Actually,
that's Tooie.
That is Tooie.
Is that a metaphor for Rare in the past 8 years?
A little bit. They proceed to make fun of themselves for a good 3 minutes, and then this new character, the King of Games, shows up. Not King of Games, the
King of Clubs.
No.
You know, I had to do it.
But he's basically a TV with a cape.
I thought he was going to say Peter Molyneux.
No! Oh, sorry. I need to recompose myself after that.
I know how much you love him.
The Lord of Games, that's it. Or Log, as he's often referred to.
All right.
He appears in the middle of their prepared battle and says that he is responsible for the creation of all good games, or of all games in general. To which point, the first stab at the heart of Rare takes place in this when Kazooie asked, "Oh, are you responsible for that Ghoulies crap?" At which point, he doesn't even respond and proceeds to set up a challenge that these two, Grunty and the heroes, will challenge. Essentially, for the winner, we'll get to determine who rules Spiral Mountain. Basically, he puts you in front of, you know, Spiral Mountain had that big path that goes around it.
Mm-hmm.
He starts you right on the path there, covers the entire thing in these trinkets, like these square pegs that rotate around. And the like, as far as the eye can see, it's really amazing looking. Thousands of them, and says, "All right, the person who collects the most wins. Go. Let the collectathon begin." At which point he stops you after a few minutes and goes, "No, this is a horrible gameplay mechanic. Why did anybody ever like this?" The whole game is like that. There are whole
the apology
levels.
Apology tour.
there are whole levels devoted to making fun of Rare. I mean, there is a museum called the Banjo Museum. It's basically just a bunch of crap from Banjo-Kazooie where they basically make fun of it. So the dumpster you have to dump trash into is full of copies of Grabbed by the Ghoulies. Completely full of them.
It sounds pretty funny. I mean, how is the gameplay, though?
So, the thing to nuts and bolts is Log takes away the fatness of the characters, but doesn't give Kazooie back any of her powers. Instead, he gives her a magical wrench with which you can build vehicles. So, the platforming, instead of using flying and these long jumps and the talon trot and things like that, you build things to accomplish similar tasks with the parts you have available. So, you go into a level, and there's a certain number of jiggy challenges available for you. Sometimes it's a race. Sometimes it's like you need to move this object from A to B. Sometimes it's you need to go find X number of these things. You need to go to get these people out of here before a certain amount of time. Stuff like that. And you're then tasked with picking a vehicle. Now, if you have a vehicle already built, you can use that. If you need to build a vehicle, you can pull up the shop and combine parts to build a vehicle you think will serve this need. Or you can use a pre-designed vehicle that you either awarded or you can buy from Wumba in her shop. A lot of the challenges are pretty simple. It can be really frustrating sometimes if you don't know what it is that makes a challenge easy to solve. So there was one where it was in what was called the Banjo Games, which was set in this Olympic stadium. And it was the shot put. You had to basically knock this giant ball as far as you could, including rolling time. And the game tells you, you probably want a vehicle with a lot of momentum. So I built the heaviest fucking vehicle I could, put as many engines in it as I possibly could,
mm-hmm.
and it moved at like 2 miles an hour. Hit the thing and it rolled a little bit, and that was the end of it. And I did not complete the objective. I was like, well, that sucked. It took me a while to determine that, you know, momentum is a function of both mass and velocity.
Yes, you'd have to maximize both.
Right, so I ended up building something that was still ridiculously heavy, but not like a mountain. Instead, I built a skyscraper, basically, with like 7 engines in it and no fuel whatsoever for like a tiny trinket of fuel because shit, I'm just going to hit this thing
mm-hmm.
and blast it into the next week. The problem with the game is that a lot of the times there's an elegant solution and then there's the more power solution.
Brute force it.
I am going to build the biggest fucking transportation vehicle ever. That way I don't need to constantly go back and forth to pick nuts from Mumbo's farm. I can just load the whole damn thing up with all the nuts on the farm and take it to the destination. So you end up with like this big giant shopping trolley the size of a city covered in inflatable balloons slowly coasting across the sky trying to get to the destination and then realizing, oh shit, how do I land this giant mass? And having it fall off the cliff.
I guess if they've honed it more so that you were sort of funneled down the path of, you know, the more direct solution, it would take some of that sort of individuality and experimentation out of it though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so I've got a car that I refer to as the Fast Racer because I got bored of naming my vehicles. And basically about a third of my challenges have me pull that out of the shop and then make unsaved modifications to it. So at the end of that challenge, all those modifications go away. And generally speaking, the modification is either I put wings on it because this shit can fly. I put extra weight on there because, like I said, this shit can fly and sometimes it flies off on its own. Or I put more engines on there or more weapons because I'm going to brute force the hell out of this thing.
Well, James, I played the demo of Nuts and Bolts, and, you know, I obviously am not as well qualified to talk about it as you are, but my impression from the demo is that it actually reminded me of a game that I think you might be surprised to hear me compare it to, but Scribblenauts. which again, I only played a demo of Scribblenauts last year at E3, but I got the same sense from both of them, which is that they give you amazing tools to do things, but the actual objectives are not that interesting or complex, and so you end up in a situation kind of like what you said, where you can a lot of times just kind of brute force your way through it by using the same solution you've used for everything else and just maybe slightly modifying it.
Right, the jetpack in Scribblenauts.
Yeah.
Which, in the sequel, there should just not be jetpacks, because it was
well,
like...
Well, that would totally go in the face of the whole premise of that game, though, which is you can write anything.
It should give you a message, no jetpacks. Because literally the jetpack was like the master key.
Yeah, I'm not saying nuts and bolts is that broken, but
no, it's not.
I just
that
felt
bad.
Like in the demo at least, I just felt like the objectives they were giving me were not really all that specialized, and so
were they mostly races?
I think mostly races. I did do the one where you had to slam into the ball that you described.
Oh yeah,
I did that one, but again, not that much different from the other ones. And
yeah, I built my giant. I guess you didn't build the giant tower of fucking terror on wheels.
I think there was one mission where it had a bunch of rings I was supposed to like jump through or something, and I just found it to be very frustrating, I think, because the jumping, basically you can put like a giant spring on the bottom of your car and it just kind of launches. It's so uncontrolled. You know,
I actually was going to talk about that level, but passed on it, because in the game at that point, you only have access to a single spring, but all your opponents have two.
Oh, okay.
So what happens is if you come back later with two springs, because you can buy one later, you're great. I tried 100 times to build a car that could jump over. Is the one we had to jump over the stupid brick walls?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So one time I put a bunch of grenade guns on the front of my car and just blew away the walls.
Okay, if that's allowed, that's pretty cool.
That's what I did. That was okay, but then I had to drive over the rubble. So I had to jack my car up so it wouldn't drive over the rubble, but then I ran into air resistance problems and got slowed down.
Well, I mean, that sounds great, though. I mean, the idea that you can iterate through all these different designs and find something that works, that's exciting. I mean, you know, I'm an engineer, too, and that's exciting to me. I guess my question for you, then, is how much of the game is made up of objectives like that, and how much of it is, like, straightforward races or get from point A to point B? I mean...
A lot of them are races, but a lot of times there's some weird environmental thing that causes you grief. So I did a race yesterday where I was racing around inside of a computer. You know, it's what people would said the inside of a computer looked like back in, like, early 90s TV shows, you know.
Like Reboot.
Yeah, exactly like Reboot. And all the characters, all the Banjo-Kazooie characters are cast based on whatever world they're in at the time. So there's like Mumbo Acres, like they're all farmers. So like Mumbo is the farm owner and Wumba is his disaffected wife. And Klungo is the idiot farmhand. In this one, Wumba was the quote gamer girl.
Ugh.
Oh, and it is the perfect stereotype of the Ubisoft, you know, that gamer girls club they had.
Yeah, frag dolls.
Yeah, she drops a phrase during the race that said, "Wow, you beat me. I'm an expert. I've been playing this for a week now." And the problem with that race is that it's a bunch of ramps, basically, really tight ramps. And if you fall, you just fall forever. You're screwed. I mean, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's too much crap overhead to fly, because the whole thing is just a bunch of interlocking platforms. The ramps are covered in this goo that causes you to spin out if you turn even slightly on them. So you have to build a vehicle with a lot of power and a lot of grip so you can line up directly onto the ramp and make the shot. I spent a lot of time building a vehicle for that race, and then finally just said, F it, and threw the controller up in the air. I came back later and put, like, wings on there, but didn't actually put propellers so it wouldn't fly. It just balanced me out, and I was able to get through it. But that shit was hard. I mean, and that's how they kind of put weird things in the races. So it's not just, like, go from A to B. It's like, yeah, go from A to B, but you're going to have to cross a big thing of water at some point.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's encouraging. I mean, that's what I would want. I would want them to basically give you some drivers, you know, some design drivers, some restrictions.
Right.
Cause that's where you really, I mean, restrictions breed creativity. If you don't have restrictions, then you don't have to be creative. You can use the same big dumb vehicle for everything.
You can use my death cart.
You can just use the jetpack every time. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. That sounds pretty encouraging, actually. Maybe I should pick up a cheap copy of this myself.
Yeah, it's pretty affordable. I've enjoyed it so far. It's long as hell, though.
All right. So, Greg, all I have down for you is surprise.
It's a mystery!
Well, I'm afraid I had to keep this on the down low because I wanted to make a very special announcement. After more than 75 weeks, I can exclusively announce now that the Excite Strike is over.
What?
Really?
Now, I'd like to be able to tell you that this is because Nintendo of Europe has lost its collective consciousness and decided to release Excitebots, but it is in fact because it was cheap on an import shop, and I went about the ways required to actually be able to play this, and I broke.
You broke.
So, does that mean Greg can finally eat after 75 weeks?
Yeah, the solidarity only lasts so long until it's affordable. There are certain other American titles that kind of play into this, like there's still nothing about Trauma Team coming to Europe, so if I want to play that.
That's a game I've been very close to picking back up lately. I barely played it when it first came out because I was overloaded, and it's been sitting in my Wii for a while. I just really need to play it.
Yeah, and there's the Kirby issue that we discussed last week.
Right.
You know, so it's not to disrespect Excitebots. It's not all about Excitebots. Yeah, finally get to play it, the Forbidden Fruit. And
Excitebots, the Forbidden Fruit.
Exactly. Yeah. It is ironic, you know, that someone wants it when apparently so few people did.
The only place Excitebots is forbidden from is the NPD charts.
Yeah. But, you know, pick it up now. I mean, obviously, it is very, very similar to Excite Truck, which I enjoyed a lot back when I picked that up a few months after the launch of the Wii over here. It does at times feel like a bit of a tacky repurposing of Excite Truck. You know, there's obviously there's certain parts of the track design that's kind of reused, and then you get some of these like wacky little challenges and mini games or environmental things sort of inserted into it, which, you know, I kind of feel differently sometimes about those. I mean, the one thing that does definitely irritate me is the fact that on pretty much every lap of every race, you have the red bar thing where you've got to sort of gyrate until it lets you go.
It starts to feel like a chore.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's too, I mean, once per race, you know, if it appeared on one of the laps but not the other, I think I would be more tolerant of that.
You start to find shortcuts and take them just so you can avoid the red bars.
Yeah, I mean, that is the cool thing about Excite Truck and Excite Bots is that there's always different kind of ways to do things. And, you know, you obviously get stars in all kind of different ways. And, yeah, some of this sort of mini game sort of silliness sort of lets you do that as well. But it's still the same formula. I still like the controls. I still like the speed. I mean, it is still a lot of fun, and certainly after, you know, however long it's been, more than 3 years, I was ready to sort of pick that kind of game back up again and have fun with it. But I did also try the online. Now, at first I was like, is anyone going to be playing this at this point, really? You know, on the basis, and then I got a game, finally. Huh. And there's like two other players there. And the thing is, what happens is that you accumulate the stars that you earn from each race over time. You know, and you can use these in the multiplayer game. You can like bet and get more stars back and stuff like that, and use that to buy like different colours or different bots to race with, all the different stuff. So the funny thing is like, here's these two guys, must be diehard Excitebots people. They've probably had it for a year. And they've got like 100,000 stars each.
Yeah.
And there's me with like 400 or whatever, because I just bought a new bot. And it's like, before the race, it invites you to bet. And so they're just like 2,500, and I'm like, I can only really afford to bet 100. <It's> thoroughly emasculating experience. It ran really well. It ran fine. It was fun.
Cool.
I enjoyed the online.
Maybe we could play sometime, because I'd love to pick back up that game and play some more of it.
Because it is an American copy, it'll work fine.
Yeah.
You know, there's no... Because, I mean, there's still a shocking amount of games that are actually region restricted in terms of online. You know, James has got Endless Ocean, Blue World, or whatever it is, the second one.
Monster Hunter is restricted.
Yeah, Monster Hunter is restricted. That, at least, you know, they're doing something weird there because it's not the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. It's their own thing.
Yeah, well, and that, yeah. and the American version has different features than the Japanese, so...
Yeah.
They're technically different versions of the game, so I understand why.
Why America and Europe is partitioned is a little less obvious to me,
right.
But something like where you've had Nintendo Wi-Fi connection games that are global, like Mario Kart, like Smash Brothers. It's bizarre to
me. Smash Brothers probably shouldn't be, but it is.
Yeah, for its own good. But, you know, like, it's a, like Endless Ocean or Mario Strikers Charged. You couldn't do cross-region play on, I mean, it's just, to me, really, really shoddy.
So inconsistent.
But yeah, with Excitebots, obviously that wasn't a problem because it was only released in one region.
Yes.
Never had to think about broaching that subject.
Well, I'm very glad that you finally got to play it.
Greg can finally eat. It's wonderful.
I know. Poor skin and bones.
Yeah, well, if I really wanted to lose weight, I would wait until the Bills beat the Patriots again.
Death.
7 years and counting.
Maybe Tom Brady will die on the field.
He did miss a whole year. We still didn't beat him.
All right, now, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, lots and lots and lots of listener mail. So stay tuned. 3DS. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, this week we've got impressions of Donkey Kong Country Returns from Aaron, who takes another look at Retro's new chapter in the DKC franchise. We've got info on gameplay, levels, controls, and art design. You know you love the Crazy Ape, so be sure to check out Aaron's impressions.
Love for the Big Ape.
There's also a review of Galactic Tazball on the DS from Neil Ronahan. This is a Way Forward created game, the developers of Shantae and Batman Brave and the Bold and Boina's Blob on the Wii. Neil says that it's the best Taz game ever made. Well, thank God for that. That is Taz, the Tasmanian Devil. Yes. There you go.
I had a dog with the case of Galactic Tazball once. It wasn't very good at all. We engage in the secondary front of Ivy the Kiwi blowout. We start with Carly's review of the game, which would be our second review. And we also have an interview from E3 with the game's, quote, creator, Yuji Naka, that Neil wrote and we both were in attendance of. And my first impression from the review is that Mr. Naka wears a lot of cream-colored clothing.
Yes, he does.
my secondary impression is that while he's listed as the creative staff in this game, he apparently had nothing to do with it.
Well, he runs the company that made it, so...
We also have Pedro's review of Disney Guilty Party, in which he reviews the Clue-inspired party game, and he comes away very impressed. You can see his review to find out why it's one of the best party games for Nintendo in a long time.
Our next review is of Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions for DS.
Hey, I've got that game.
And the aforementioned Metroidvania take on the Spider-Man franchise by Neil Ronahan. Does it keep the strong handheld heritage of the series alive, or does it fall short? Neil clues you in with his review. And don't forget this week's edition of the Flips Twisted World Developer Journal, Shader, Where Art Thou? In which Frozen North's Douglas Gregory continues the stellar series of inside looks at the game's development with a discussion of shaders. What are shaders? Read this article and find out all about them, why they're important to the look of a game, and what the Wii can and can't do with them. We hardware nerds will love this article.
Reading this article made me realize why there's such a wide range of graphics on the Wii and why you can really tell when certain developers put in a lot of effort on the graphics, because you could tell it's really tricky to make things look good, but it is totally possible if you kind of learn how the system works. All right, that's it. Check out all this great original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Thank you.
Well, hello there. We're back for part two of Radio Free Nintendo. It's listener mail time. The address is R to the Nintendo World Report to the .com. First up, we've got some questions about 3DS. Ryan from Anaheim, California writes, "By now, we all know the leaked, quote-unquote, leaked specs of the 3DS. I'm sure there will be a lengthy discussion about it on the next show. One thing I've noticed is that quite a few people are saying, I'll just wait for the better version they put out a year later. Do you think there's a real possibility of Nintendo pulling a 3DS Lite on us? The GBA SP and DS Lite rectified the design flaws of their predecessors, so I believe there won't be a second 3DS anytime soon unless there's an immediate demand for an improved model. What say you?" So the leak specs that Ryan is writing about, maybe we could go over them very quickly just for people who haven't seen those. They're obviously not official. They're not totally confirmed. They seem very likely. James, you want to read these out? You probably understand them a lot better anyway.
So, these stats came from IGN through a source they have.
I mean, I remember IGN leaked a lot of stuff about Gecko back in the late 90s, you know,
right,
2000.
They have contacts.
Yeah, they have a long history of getting sort of scoops on hardware stuff like this.
So the 3DS I'm not sure if it's two core or if it's two ARM 11 CPUs.
Yeah, it's two separate CPUs. The DS had two different CPUs
they
as
had,
well.
It had an ARM 7 and an ARM 5.
Right, so that was asymmetric. There were two different kinds of CPUs.
This is two ARM 11s that run at 266 megahertz
each,
and a 133 megahertz GPU.
Mm-hmm.
It's got 4 megabytes of dedicated video RAM, 64 megabytes of conventional RAM, and 1.5 gigabytes of flash storage.
Okay. The flash storage is interesting. That's three times as much as the Wii.
Yeah.
It's not a ton, but it's a respectable amount of flash storage.
Well, and the DSi only has 256. So.
Right. I mean, it's almost as much as an iPod Shuffle. So we're getting up there. We're catching up.
We're catching up to 2003.
I know a lot of people in our forums were saying that, well, that sounds pretty good, but I certainly hope that they do a better job of SD card implementation.
Yeah.
The 3DS does have a slot for SD card. I hope they actually use it this time, because on DSi, it's quite poorly used. So
no, despite the fact that the DSi came out at a similar time to when they liberalized the SD card on Wii, it has never been liberalized in the same way.
Right. You're still fridge cleaning on DSi,
yeah,
which is stupid, obviously. So, you know, I certainly hope they kind of deal with that better right up front on 3DS. The two processors, that doesn't surprise me much. I guess there was a lot of talk about them using something called a Tegra that is a mystery to me. I don't know much about processors, but Nintendo's been using ARM processors, ARM, since at least the GBA. Before that they had like a Z80 in the Game Boy Color, right? So the GBA, though, had an ARM, and the DS, of course, did. So they've had a lot of success with those processors. They're very low power, and they're very reliable processors. So I think it's encouraging that they're using basically two processors that are both better than either one on the DS. They're the same, so that will probably help developers quite a bit, because they don't have to worry about the asymmetry of, you know, which processor do I use now and how do I divide up all these tasks. It'll probably be a lot more straightforward now. The fact that there is a GPU is kind of exciting. The DS Nintendo's never made a handheld with a GPU. I know a lot of people have sort of complained that 133 megahertz is slow. It sounds slow. In GPU terms, I don't really know.
That is slow,
yeah.
Yes.
I remember on the PSP that the processor that's in, I don't know if it's the CPU or the GPU in the PSP, but man, there's too many damn acronyms here. But whichever processor it was, that thing originally was running at like a lower speed than it could be.
It got overclocked. People broke the device and then would actually overclock it on their like homebrew apps,
right,
or whatever.
And eventually, right, at least, eventually Sony updated the firmware for PSP and allowed developers to overclock it, basically. Not to overclock it, but to access the higher speeds that were possible.
The additional power that it had,
right,
that it wasn't using.
Right. And so now there are quite a... I mean, Sony originally had limited the speed of that thing in order to try to save battery life. And eventually developers were like, hey, we want this power. We don't care about battery life, so...
Yeah, no one who owns a PSP cares about battery life.
It's a futile effort.
So, you know, with 3DS, that could very well follow a similar path. This thing, apparently the vendor's website says this thing can run at 200 megahertz, and it can be overclocked up to 400. But, you know, in terms of normal games, it seems likely that at some point Nintendo could allow people to actually use the full 200 megahertz instead of the standard 133. I don't know, do you guys have any other thoughts on the specs so far?
It's just when people saw, you know, how good the games looked and all that, I guess it kind of maybe sparked off, you know, some thoughts about exactly what kind of technology was underpinning it. And what we've really seen the takeaway with this sort of set of specs is that, you know, this is very much a Nintendo approach to making a handheld once again. You know, these are not particularly cutting edge components. That, you know, it is in many ways comparable to a PSP with certain enhancements, which of course is, you know, 6 years old just about.
Right.
It is very much again looking at cost and battery life. That's, you know, go back to the Game Boy. That's been the underpinning kind of philosophy of Nintendo handheld hardware design for a very long time. And the only thing I'll say is that perhaps if the unit is somewhat higher price, as some people have been predicting, you know, about 250 or whatever, perhaps given the context of the somewhat lower end specs, it might be cause for some people to get a little bit more upset about that higher pricing than otherwise might be the case.
It could. Yeah, I do think it sounds like a very Nintendo style system architecture. I mean, they've been known for a long time for developing these sort of very lean sets of chips and RAM also that seem underpowered, and yet they do more than you would expect them to. I remember when GameCube first came out, a lot of developers, including Silicon Knights, for example, were saying, you know, we were worried about the specs when we saw them, but then we started pushing things through the system and were really surprised at how well it was able to handle all this. And they ended up being able to make a lot of games that looked basically just as good as the competitors, if not better, on hardware that seems on the face of it to be less powerful. But that hasn't really happened with the Wii because it's so much less powerful than the competitors.
Well, I mean, we discussed it during the Now Playing segment with the shaders. It's very much how a system is architected, much more so than the raw power numbers. Yeah. So, I mean, you can have a great system, but if your memory management is shit, you're still dead in the water. And I believe that was the problem. One of the problems the GameCube had was it had an issue where you couldn't use its full power because of memory management, I think. And that they talked about how they resolved that in the Wii. But it's really going to come down to what the system can do computationally. And not just that. I mean, you have to keep in mind that this is a small resolution screen and you're pumping a lot of power per pixel, right, at least, through it. So you can do a lot, and you might not get fine detail, but you wouldn't be able to see that detail on that resolution anyway.
You know, something we've talked about before is how 3DS seems like it might naturally focus more gameplay on the top screen because that's the one that's 3D. And I wonder if these specs kind of reflect that because, you know, one of the issues with DS is because it has two screens, even though the screens are small and the resolution is low, you do have to pump out graphics to both of those. And I know that was sometimes a problem with DS games. On 3DS, I wonder if there's kind of just an assumed inclination towards focusing more on one screen at a time and having less on the second screen, on the touch screen. And so maybe the specs don't need to be as high as you might think because they really only have to worry about one screen.
Although the 3D screen in itself is kind of like two screens.
Yeah, it's really like three screens. I mean,
it is to some extent, yeah.
But, I mean, the screens have different numbers of pixels in them, too. One screen is smaller than the other and has...
They're very different.
Well, to address Ryan's question, which I think is actually really a question very much apart from these specs, the question of, is there going to be a 3DS Lite? Should you wait?
We've had this before some weeks ago, probably a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. It's a natural thing to wonder about, but
sure.
I mean, I think what we said then is just that they're not rushing this to market in the way they were with DS. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you're going to have the sort of same kind of obvious design awkwardness. Certainly what we've seen of 3DS so far doesn't suggest that. So, I mean, I don't expect anything as radical as what we've seen in the past with the jump to SP or Lite very soon. But I'm sure they'll think of something to improve.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they want to redesign these systems every few years so that you'll buy a new one.
It may not be as necessary, but they'll still do it.
I expect that when they do release a 3DS Lite, and it might be longer before that happens if the first system is well made and doesn't have any pressing need to...
And we've all held one, and I can't identify any pressing needs.
No, I can't either.
Nothing obvious.
The cameras are shitty.
But that's not getting fixed.
That seems to be a corporate mentality, so...
But my more pressing issue, my more pressing issue with the 3DS is that top screen feels so small compared to the DS.
The IXL.
It just feels so goddamn small.
I'm not sure there's
much they can do about that because a third-party vendor is producing these screens for them.
Yeah,
so.
That didn't bother me at all.
But you don't have an XL. You don't have...
I've played an XL. I don't have
one.
You
don't regularly play a game holding two screens that are the size of Alaska each.
No, I don't.
Kodiak bears sometimes wander across my top screen looking for water.
So I expect that when 3DS Lite is eventually released, it'll probably be 3 or 4 years from now. And also I think that it'll probably be more like the upgrade from DS Lite to DSi. It'll be probably a minor revision, you know. A couple things that people have asked for, a couple things that you don't really need, but they help justify the price or whatever. So,
which will be exorbitant.
If you want a 3DS, you should buy a 3DS when it comes out.
You know what? I'm going to go ahead and call it right now. You won't be able to.
Well, yeah, it'll probably be hard.
Because they'll make a million of them. And then...
God.
I certainly don't think these specs that we've been talking about are going to change anytime soon. I mean, assuming these are real specs, but they're not going to increase the processor speed in a 3DS Lite.
I mean, DSi did actually change the specs of the DS Lite.
It did.
It's because they're running that operating system.
Well, do we know if any of the DSi-only retail games use it?
I've heard some developers claim that it helped them, you know, and a lot of the DSiWare games, you know, I've read interviews with DSiWare developers who say that they, you know, enjoyed having the extra processor or whatever, but it's not a very significant increase, and because it breaks compatibility with other systems, not really any developers are taking advantage
of
it.
Yeah, it's not worthwhile to go down that restrictive road.
Anyway, let's move on. James, you have the next question.
Wyatt from New Hampshire writes, with Nintendo unveiling the price and release date for the 3DS on September 29th, what do you expect them to announce? What do you think of the rumor the 3DS will have 3G? How about a pack-in? Will we be able to install games, virtual console, and most importantly, will it at least have a universal friend code?
First off, I want to give a shout-out to Wyatt. I think this is the first time he's written in, but Wyatt was at our PAX East Live panel. And he's a big fan of the show. He's been listening for a long time, so I'm glad that he finally wrote in. So, prediction time, boys.
Yeah, this is it. This is the last time we'll record before the announcement.
I'm excited. Not so much for the release date and price, because I think those are pretty easy to predict. You know, I don't expect any shocks there. I'm excited to see, like, kind of the launch.
It's out now!
They're going to show a lot of software for it. I think they're going to have to announce some details on things like online capability, 3DSware.
Yeah, any previously sort of, you know, they've hinted at other hardware feature that's yet to be revealed or anything like that. So the curtain's
got to... 3G could be that. I don't really expect them to do 3G.
No. You go back to the sort of tech specs. It just doesn't really fit into that paradigm that we're seeing.
No, it doesn't seem that useful either. I mean, it's kind of a neat thing to have, but if you look at what Amazon's done with a Kindle, I didn't buy a Kindle until they took out 3G. Because it adds $50 to the price, and it's pointless.
Yeah.
If it has Wi-Fi, I don't need 3G.
And especially when you look at it from that Japan-centric point of view that we keep talking about.
I mean, the biggest problem with 3G is that they would have to arrange deals with...
Negotiate with carriers around the world.
Right. So, like, sure, you could go to North America and hit Verizon and go to Europe and hit Vodafone and be done with North America and Western Europe, but you've still got the rest of the fucking world to deal with.
Right.
And I'm going to tell you, you're going to have a hard time finding a 3G carrier that you can reliably count
on.
In
Brazil.
Right. Any emerging market, you're going to have difficulty dealing with
Mexico.
That.
You know, they sell a lot of DSs in Mexico.
They do sell a lot of DSs in Mexico.
So, yeah, you're totally right, James.
And to be honest, 3G still isn't available everywhere anyway.
Right. Again, it's a neat idea, but what does it really add to the functionality of a gaming system? You can maybe play some online games over 3G, but you'd prefer to do it over Wi-Fi because you have less latency.
Right.
And Wi-Fi is pretty easy to find at this point. So I think the main reason that Nintendo would want to do it is so that you can more easily buy games off their store, off their online store.
And then there's sort of a persistent online functionality.
Sure. And again, I would suggest that there might even be maybe an asynchronous way to do that, which I've mentioned before.
That's whatever they've said points in that direction. Mm-hmm. To whatever extent they are going to try and work in a kind of persistent online element by the back door.
Right. There's definitely going to be some weird wireless features on this thing. They've already talked about some of them. I think there's more to come. The way it's going to use Wi-Fi and local wireless is going to be, I don't know if revolutionary is the right word, it's going to be different. It's going to be innovative. We'll see how well it works out. So some of the other things Wyatt suggested, game pack-in, I'm going to say no.
The only thing I can think of with a game pack-in is if for some reason they're looking at the pricing. It's the thing with trying to put a price is that obviously, you know, it's not as continuous as it might be. Yeah. You know, people are going to say, well, there's psychological barriers at this number or that number. You know, say, for instance, if they want to go over $200 in America, they're like, 200's too low for whatever reason. But then it's like, well, do we really want to go at something like 210? You know, you sort of break that 200 barrier, but for seemingly a little amount. Where at what point do you then maybe say, well, actually, we'll go more over 200 than we might otherwise do, but we'll add value by putting a pack in there, and we feel that's kind of the best combination. Yeah, it's
well, Greg, you know, the last time Nintendo did a handheld launch with a pack-in game was Tetris.
Yep. Yeah. I have it. I have it.
1989. I don't really see them going back to
I think the only scenario is where for some reason there's some idiosyncrasy, some little peculiarity
It's feasible.
They just think the pricing alchemy kind of comes out best that way.
I think it's very unlikely.
I think there was some of that with Wii from the point of view that, you know, they didn't pack Wii Sports in Japan, but they did everywhere else. I mean, I think that probably had something to do with pricing.
Well, there will be 3D movies and 3D game demos. There might be some applications that are built in on the flash memory. There might be like a free 3DS wear game.
Yeah, like they do with the DSi preloaded.
Right.
Yeah.
There might be a game cartridge with a demo on it, but...
Metroid Prime Hunters 3D?
No, obviously not. But I think it actually...
Because that was horrible.
It's more cost-effective if you're going to include a gameplay demo like that, which they probably will. It's more cost-effective just preloaded on the flash memory than it is to print out all these cartridges that are going to get thrown away. I mean, how many people still have their First Hunt cartridge lying around within access?
I do.
It's like, it's stupid. Nobody wants a demo cartridge or a demo disc. You want to download it. Universal friend code, I say yes. The time is now.
Yeah, you got to worry if it doesn't happen now.
Yes. I think there will be a universal friend code. It's attached to your system. Or maybe you even create an account. But yes, one way or another, I think there will be one friend code for all 3DS games. Virtual console, I'm more skeptical about. But if for whatever reason they don't have Virtual Console ready for launch, it's quite feasible that's something they could add later. With firmware updates and all that.
Yeah, I guess the big thing as well is, are they going to start with old portable games, or are they going to start with some of the formats we've already got on the Wii Virtual Console?
Or 3D Xevious?
It'll be quite interesting to see how they approach that, but I think it's going to happen either at launch or early. You know, I don't think this is something we'll have to wait. You know, like, WiiWare didn't get going for nearly 2 years after the Wii was out. I don't think it's going to be
that. But Virtual Console was ready day one.
It was, and they made quite a big deal out of it relative to people they had. You know,
and it was very successful in the early days.
Yeah,
they
had a lot of announcements all their partners and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know. Maybe that could form part of the press conference that we're going to see a week from now, roughly. I mean, I suppose one thing though is that we'll be discussing a lot of these details. Do we expect them to lift the lid outside of Japan? Is this going to be just for the Japanese? Obviously, like, the hardware stuff applies to us all, but pricing, release date, all that kind of stuff, which, you know, is not that exciting, but, you know, a lot of people will care. Are we actually going to find out?
I think they very well could. They very well could announce Japan or America and Europe, stuff like that.
Would you be shocked at all if they said it's coming out this day in Japan for this price and said, see you at region-specific release date events, and then basically walked off the stage?
Oh, God. Another announcement of an announcement.
No, hold on. And then we get a press email at some point that day saying, join us in New York City or in San Francisco on X day, and then we find out that in Europe they're going to do the same fucking thing.
I think it's quite possible that they will say North America, spring 2011, and then we won't get the real American release date and price until, like, the second week of January. Ugh. That would not surprise me at all.
How much of a dick move would it be for them to do that, though?
They've done it before.
I know they've done it before, but, I mean, let's just put it on the dick move scale. Is it a 7?
Where's the Petrino on this game?
Petrino's an 8 until he did the Sui call, and he's a 10.
Okay, maybe we should move on, but... we should say before we move on that the whole September 29th announcement, of course, will be covered extensively on NintendoWorldReport.com. We'll have all the details for you as soon as possible. We have guys to translate all the Japanese press releases and things like that, so we will be on the case. And typically, the way these work is that you should probably, if you really want to follow it up to the minute, you should probably be looking like the night before, really late at night, because of the time zone differences.
Right. I thought it was in the late morning. It's in the same venue they use for TGS.
Oh, interesting.
So they've got something more than just a press conference planned.
Yeah, I expect there will be playable demos there and a lot.
But that's still a huge venue. I mean,
it's a secret TGS. Is that what you're saying? They're doing some surprise Space World.
I think what we're more likely to see is an event that extends over more than like a couple hours.
Mm, interesting.
Like 3, 4, 5 hours of hands-on time, possibly with a bunch of third-party games present.
Yeah, there will be tons of third-party press releases announcing games that day.
Oh yeah, we're gonna get awash in them. I mean, I might have to take the day off that day just to handle the press releases, so I can stay up late enough to do the damn press releases.
Yeah, exactly. These are some of my favorite days to work on the website, because it's so exciting when, you know, Nintendo so rarely announces anything. They're so secretive that when they do blow the lid off these things, and it's often in the middle of the night, and you're up with 5 or 6 other people, and, you know, everybody's trying to write it up and get all the screenshots and the release dates updated, it's really fun.
It is also going to be interesting to see, of all the kind of stuff that was spouted at E3, all the franchise names, all the demos, all the kind of, you know, is it a game? Is it a tech demo? Is this really going to be a final box product? You know, how much of that stuff is legit? How much of it is coming at launch? How much of it is scheduled to come a little bit after that? You know, it's going to be interesting to see all that kind of materialize, which, as you know, it's pretty much got to at this point. Mm-hmm.
I think what will be interesting is, A, if we do get, like, legitimate hands-on time with a lot of these games that we don't know anything about, and B, what companies they bring in to show their stuff. So, like, do they basically just bring in a bunch of Japanese interested games?
I don't think Vicarious Visions is going to be showing off their 3DS games at this thing.
I've already played DJ Hero, though. I mean, that was the most playable demo I saw there, except for like the Pilot Wings one. I mean,
I don't think Nintendo of America, for instance, has really said very much at all about this event.
I don't think they've said anything about it.
Yeah, and I don't think Europe has. I think this is a very Japan-centric event. Now, a lot of what is announced there will be applicable to everybody.
Yeah,
and we'll all be watching it. But again, I wouldn't expect to see a lot of American-made games there. I don't really expect to see an American release date either.
I wouldn't be surprised if, when the news comes out about it, that especially like Nintendo of Australia is finding out this shit for the first time too.
Mm.
Like and I'm not joking, because I remember at the Nintendo press conference at the last E3, Nintendo Central America people who were there didn't know the shit that was getting announced.
Sure.
They were like freaking the fuck out. Like, they just watched their team win the World Cup 7 times because somebody announced the vitality sensor.
Yeah, I mean, I think Reggie has a heads up, but, you know, his people are need to know, and they don't really need to know right now because it's not coming out until next year.
Well, them and Jimmy Fallon.
Them and Jimmy Fallon. So, we got to move on. Thanks for the great letter. And Greg has the next one.
James writes, not that
James.
One. Jumping off your discussion on Japanese gaming trends, I was curious to hear what you guys had to say about Western gaming trends. Obviously, shooters, sandbox, and action games with emphasis on story and production values are dominating development, but is this trend just beginning, or will we see something else rise up in the near future? Are budgets getting out of control to the point of the business model being unsustainable, and then see a dramatic shift in game style?
I don't think the kinds of games that are being made in the West right now are very different than they were 10 years ago.
No, that's the problem.
Maybe. I mean, Japan has the same situation. I think.
I know. I mean, it's not any different.
Well,
I
think there's a lot of innovation within these genres, but I don't really see a new American or European genre rising to
prominence. I might say that in some ways, I mean, one of the more significant difference, and this is not to diminish the differences that do exist on the development side between Japan and the West, but the more significant difference is in the market for them. The market for the games in the West is burgeoning, you know, it's growing, it's healthy, whereas the Japan console market is shrinking. That, to me, is the principal difference between the two, and that does feed into development as well. You know, the more vibrant and growing the marketplace is, the more sort of, you know, new entrants will come in and think they can carve out their own niche, and they bring new ideas and things like that to the table. So, I mean, one does kind of feed into the other.
Well, I think the primary issue with how game development has occurred in the West is actually summarized pretty well in an open letter written to Bobby Kotick. But basically, a lot of the games that are being produced in the big corporate-owned studios are iterative, big, high-budget titles.
Mm-hmm. Low risk. Creatively low risk. They might be financially high risk.
Well, they're formulaic, you know. It's like, well, people like this plus this that we market research shows people also like equals this, and we think it'll make this much. And, you know, trying to kind of boil down the process of making a game to a kind of a pseudoscience that you can predict what is going to be successful.
I know it's a tired commentary, but what's happened with the Medal of Honor franchise? Medal of Honor. Well, yeah, actually, that is a good example, because look at what this new game is.
It's Call of Duty.
Yeah.
Well, Medal of Honor begets Call of Duty, begets Medal of Honor.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot of follow the leader going on in this particular market.
I think, on the sustainability question, I mean, the thing is, we're already seeing that the chances are the HD consoles are going to keep going rather than go away after 5 years. And I think that's because, you know, it would be unsustainable to have another step change in development costs. But as they are at the minute, I think people have sort of got to grips with them more. What isn't sustainable is this idea that everyone tries to make the big budget game, and then only so many of them are going to succeed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you think you're going to be one of the lucky ones. You know, obviously, so many of those are going to fail, and that's going to mean a lot of developers and publishers in financial trouble. I think what's probably going to happen more over time is that the Activisions and EAs, the real publishing giants, are just going to have more exclusive kind of domain over that part of the industry. And then hopefully, as more price flexibility comes into the market, everyone else is going to be able to sort of shoot for different targets rather than the same blockbuster target.
Yeah, and that's typical as a hardware cycle matures, as you get into the fourth and fifth and sixth year of a console, that you start to have studios and even publishers who are able to create things that are maybe a little outside of the mainstream, but there's enough of an install base that they can find enough people to buy it that makes it worth doing. And that's why you get weird stuff like Odin Sphere coming out in, 2006 for PlayStation 2? 2005, 2006? You know, that's going to start happening. That's great. So even though you might think that these big-time genres and these blockbuster games are stagnating, because the cycle, the generation is more mature, you have more room opening up, as Greg said, in the middle for other people to find their own niches. And the niche is large enough because of the install base that it's sustainable. And I'm excited about that. I think that's starting to happen. And I also think that in terms of innovation, I think that the Western market and Western developers are probably doing better at independent development. They've embraced these digital platforms, these smaller, cheaper games, better than than Japan has. And so because of that, because you have these places like Xbox Live Arcade, even WiiWare, which is much bigger in the West than it is in Japan.
No doubt.
And you have smaller studios doing it in the West. In Japan, a lot of the WiiWare games come from the big, you know, from Konami and stuff like that. So I think that aspect of the industry is much healthier in the West, and we're seeing a lot of innovation there. So again, it's just becoming more stratified and more full. You know, I feel like the range is getting broader, and it's also kind of filling up from within with a lot of really cool ideas. So I feel very good about trends in Western gaming, not necessarily in the trend of like, you know, we got to add 3D to Killzone and shit like that, because I don't care. but I do think that there's a lot going on, especially if you look under the surface of the stuff that GameStop is trying to pre-sell. You know, if you go a little bit deeper down and you if you're listening to this podcast, you are well educated on enough of the market that you can find games like Flip's Twisted World that could be very innovative and very interesting, Lost in Shadow, stuff like that, even on the Wii, is really interesting stuff, you know. Well, Lost in Shadow is a Japanese game, but Flip's Twisted World is not. So I think there's a lot of really cool stuff like that. And, you know, Bit Trip games are fascinating. Really, they're not really like anything else, and they're being made right here in America.
It's a weird question for me to answer, really, because I feel quite estranged from Western games in many ways. In fact, being exposed to a lot of this stuff really for the first time in the year that I've had my PS3, because I've never been a PC gamer for a start. And then beyond that, I've always had the Nintendo consoles, which means my exposure to Western games is pretty much limited to the aforementioned Rare games of the 16 and 64-bit eras, which is sort of quite particular. But that's the thing. And in that way, it is funny because I've struggled to get into some of this stuff, you know, FPS. I still haven't played a GTA game.
Oh, wow. There are learning curves to these things as well.
I imagine it's like someone, you know, coming into JRPGs now or something, you know, if you didn't ever play like an FF4/2 back in the day, or Chrono Trigger or whatever. It is kind of difficult because they do, not perhaps to the same extent as something like Madden, but there is something of an assumed base of knowledge that you'll have that's built up over several years and games.
All right. Thanks, James, for the letter. Not you, James.
You're welcome.
Moving on, the next letter is from Sergeant Foster, a.k.a. Controller Flex, who's writing in from Okinawa, Japan. The discussions have been great, and I was just able to listen to the other MCAS yesterday as well. I think I agree with everything you guys said, except for when Johnny said he liked the god-awful, over-the-shoulder, under-the-armpit camera crap. But what Johnny says goes.
That's not true.
I'll respond to that later.
I'll respond to that now. That is patently false. What Johnny says does not go.
He's got all these ellipses in there too. It's really funny the way he wrote it.
What Johnny says goes out my ear and ignored.
Yeah, I think Sergeant Foster, you should go back and listen to that discussion again. I like the idea.
I think he definitely should not.
Go listen to the whole hour and a half Metro discussion again. The over the shoulder stuff in Other M, I like the idea of it. I don't think it's used very effectively, but I think it could have been.
What about the fact that a number of them take place when you come upon a toilet for the first time in a Metroid game?
Yeah, there's really weird usage of that thing.
How do space pirates flush the toilet? Do they form into a
ball? I was hoping I'd find that out, and I didn't.
Do they form into a ball and then drop a bomb in there? I mean, every switch in a space pirate base is completely fucked. I mean, you shoot it or you blow it up. How do they flush a toilet?
They're a very violent species, you know.
Exactly.
With a deep fascination for tubes.
Let me finish this letter from Sergeant Foster.
Nope.
Anyway, here is my question to you. Developers are showing mad support for the HD consoles well into 2011, and some games are even planned for a 2012 release, which shows confidence in the survivability of those platforms. With no Wii placement in sight, and Zelda Skyward Sword is arguably their biggest upcoming release, which I don't believe to be a system seller, what will help their home console survive other than another inevitable price drop through 2011? Additionally, how much more far advanced will the other systems seem by holiday 2011 to even warrant a Wii purchase or a third-party developer to even make a game for the system? Great observation about the level of confidence in publishers in the HD platforms, because, yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but the fact that you've got stuff like Bioshock Infinite announced for a 2012 release on 360 and PS3 and PC means that a very major company, Take-Two, is expecting those systems to be viable in 2012.
Yeah, right. It's as we said before, it's just all the economics of game development right now just all go in that direction.
Yeah, but do we expect a lot of high-profile Wii games to be released in 2012? I don't. Certainly nothing on the level of interest of Bioshock Infinite, which looks fucking awesome.
Look, Nintendo always tend to have this weird approach to the sort of time horizon for games. You know, there's always a period where it's like, God, what the hell is coming out after this point? And then they might announce quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah, they've done that a couple times with Wii, haven't they?
Yes.
You know, that's Nintendo's policy. The problem is there's not a whole lot of third-party stuff. There's some interesting third-party stuff for Wii coming out this holiday season. But third parties aren't nearly as secretive as Nintendo about announcing games ahead of time, and there's not much announced for 2011 on the Wii. And I agree with Sergeant Foster. I'm beginning to worry that there might not ever be that much stuff announced for 2011 on the Wii. I mean, we know about Zelda. That's probably in the spring.
Yes, because that's coming out in 2011.
And I'm sure Nintendo will have other stuff for next holiday season, Wii Music 2, for instance. But from third parties, I don't know that. I mean, it does feel like the steam is running out here on third-party support for Wii. Even in Japan, it's bad.
Yeah, I mean, in Japan, Nintendo has more stuff under their umbrella, you know, like Xenoblade and The Last Story and whatnot to kind of to keep things going. But you know, the third-party situation is not any more heartening. I think there is very obviously the possibility that the system will simply wind down because it will be replaced.
Well, they've already kind of tried to refresh it with Motion Plus, and that sank like a brick.
It seems like that was a fairly weak attempt. You know, it was mostly a way of selling Wii Sports Resort.
I think there was an element of keeping up with the Joneses, because they knew that Kinect, well, Project Natal and Move were going to be announced, and you know, they wanted to show that they were thinking about this as well. And they needed to do Motion Plus. I mean, if they hadn't released Motion Plus, PlayStation Move would be a hell of a lot more exciting right now, because it is considerably more advanced than even Motion Plus. It has the same technology as that thing has Motion Plus in it, plus a bunch of other shit. So I think in that sense, Motion Plus was an effective parry, basically. But they can't do Motion Plus 2.
No.
And I don't think Vitality Sensor is going to wake up the market.
No, to me, you know, looking at how many units they've already sold, how much they've already gone to the well on the franchises, it all has the feel of a cycle coming to an end in the not-distant future at all.
Yeah.
And of course, there is the issue of the technology. As we all know, you know, it was already behind. Then you've got the issue of 360 and PS3, you know, bringing motion controls into their ecosystems or whatever, however successful they're going to be or whatever. You certainly say now that they've got that element of the experience as part of the brand. But I mean, to me, it's simply going to be a question of at what point do they feel that to keep the flow of revenue coming in from hardware sales, they need to do something with a new console. And that point can't be far in coming.
And I think they need to make it up to third parties. You know, they need to find a way to reignite the interest of third parties. They've done a great job with 3DS. And with Wii, you know, they started out with pretty good third-party support for Wii. I mean, at least there's a lot of interest. I don't know how much of that came to market, but there was a lot of excitement among developers. And over time, that has significantly eroded.
Yeah, I mean, there was a testing of the waters. It seemed like there was a weird back and forth in terms of, you know, in the very early going, a lot of publishers were not very interested at all.
And they saw the sales.
Certain players like Ubisoft were sort of more in on the ground floor and did all right out of that. Then the sales take off. A lot of people dip their toes in the water and then find they don't like what they what they felt.
Yeah.
They felt the sting of disinterest.
After that, it's been a kind of steady decline.
Yeah, I mean, mark your calendar for E3 2011. There will be a point in the press conference where Reggie says, "And we haven't forgotten about the Wii," announcing Wii Party 2 with Vitality Sensor support. I mean, that's going to be like the token shit that they announce for Wii because they've blown their load on the next console. So whether they announce the new console or not, that's the kind of game that they're going to be announcing at E3 next year.
Yeah, I can't imagine there's going to be anything for which it could be really considered mind-blowing or, you know, earth-shattering.
They might throw a bone to the hardcore. They might do like an F-Zero or something crazy like that.
Right. Yeah, and Pikmin and, yeah.
And there'll be some more casual stuff that's cheap to make. I mean, Wii Party 2 is a very real possibility, you know, for next year. Plus.
Yeah.
But nothing really major after Zelda for Wii, I think. Next year's going to be really interesting for all the consoles, because you'll also kind of see whether the, you know, Move and Kinect kind of float or not. And
yep. You got 3DS as well.
Yeah, and of course, 3DS is going to disrupt the hell out of the handheld market. And maybe it might be a new PSP as well. So, a lot of new stuff. So anyway, moving on.
Nathan Fouts from Mommy's Best Games writes, "Hey guys, it's not coming to Nintendo, but check out our next game, Explosionade. It's just like Lemonade, but with explosions. It'll be coming to Xbox Live Indie Games within a week."
Yeah, we got this email from Nathan over at Mommy's Best Games earlier this week, and it's still not out the last time I checked, Explosionade. I don't know what it's going to cost, but his last game, Shoot One Up, was $1. So it's going to be cheap and pretty much guaranteed to be awesome. Those guys, they made Weapon of Choice. They're making Grapple Buggy. Fucking Grapple Buggy. It's still in the works. And basically, he's saying that they're still looking for a publisher. They're like negotiating with a lot of people on Grapple Buggy, and they may be coming close to a deal on that. But in the meantime, in order to fund the development of Grapple Buggy, he made Shoot One Up, and now he's making Explosionade, and it should be out very soon. I'm very excited to play it and very upset that it's probably going to come out while my Xbox is being repaired.
Oh, of course.
So that disrupted Johnny's plans of getting the game for free by that pitch.
For free? I don't even think you can gift indie games.
You can give codes.
I don't expect to get anything free from them other than that blow-up orca that I won back at PAX East.
That was so weird.
Yes, indeed. Clearly, like, random shit from the dollar store, which I love, with a sticker on it. So, yes. No, Mommy's Best Games is awesome, and I cannot wait to see more of Explosionade. Just I told Nathan we would be happy to spread the word, and now we have.
More of this downloadable Xbox stuff that I would like.
Sorry, Greg.
Shadow Complex, Geometry Wars 2.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sad enough.
Well, you and I are in the same boat for at least a couple of weeks.
The solidarity. Oh.
Yes.
If you find your touch-sensitive button has run into a bad case of being sledgehammered before Radiant Silver Gun comes out, you'll know what's going on.
Greg is sabotaging me from 5,000 miles away.
I've got to have means.
The solidarity Johnny can express with Greg right now is commensurate to the solidarity Greg can express with his European counterparts over ExciteBots.
It was a year and a half. It's a good run. We have to finish up someday.
A good run. All right, Greg, you've got the last email here.
Okay, so Michael, a.k.a. Mikeman, writes, "Boot up your Wii. Open the Nintendo channel and take a look at the video which is currently on the front page."
I refuse.
"After an embarrassingly poor performance playing New Super Mario Bros. Wii, they've returned and they're taking a stab at Super Metroid. Is the guy playing Super Metroid in the red shirt actually John Lindemann? They sound alike and appear to have the same mannerisms." Now, stop right there. I have to put this addendum to this letter before we move on. Normally, when we get listener mails, what we don't include in the message is the subject line.
Right.
From the, yes. Because that, you know, when you copy the text out of the message, you know, that's not in there.
Right.
But in this case, it's very relevant because the question is it John Lindemann? But the subject line for the message was, two douchebags play Super Metroid. So James, on that basis, can you confirm that it is John Lindemann?
It is not John Lindemann, and there's a few ways.
Oh no. Is it someone in a John Lindemann mask?
No, because you have to wear a bald cap too.
He doesn't look anything like John. I don't think he sounds like him either.
There's a few ways you can be definitive if this is John.
Is this your ways to spot a Lindemann in the wild?
Yes.
The first test is, will it blend?
The first test is, do you need to wear sunglasses to see it?
So we call this test the camera test. Point an object that appears to be a camera at the possible Lindemann and make sure he's aware. If he poses like a douchebag, it might be John Lindemann. The second test is to say anything that could possibly ever, even in the most remote sense, be construed as homoerotic. If he giggles, it might be John Lindemann. And the third test is to mention an obscure hockey player from the 1980s from a Canadian team and say, man, he sucked. And if he punches you in the face, it's John Lindemann. Congratulations.
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't like to make fun of guys when they're not here because I've been burnt by that in the past.
It's all fair.
Suffice it to say, John, we love you, and this is what happens when you give us late notice that you're going to miss the show.
Nah, it would have happened otherwise. If you were here, it would have still happened, so it's fine.
I believe you.
I mean, there's a whole forum right now devoted to propagating pictures of John Lindemann posing like a douchebag.
Yeah,
so we're good.
People who listen to our show, if you don't hang out on the forums, it really is worth going to check out the B. John Lindemann Funhouse. The thread that James made, I don't know if I've ever in my life laughed so much. James,
it's like lolcats with John.
Yes, James started this meme where he asked people on the forums to change their avatar to a picture of John looking goofy. And I don't even, James, where I don't know where you found these pictures. Oh my God.
There's a deep throat style source that's leaking these to James.
These are E3 pictures, and when there was a potted plant in the window, pictures were delivered to me, yes. And then Aaron supplemented this source with John's many embarrassing Facebook pictures, including a picture of a young John Lindemann with hair. I mean, that's the best way of describing it.
I didn't really recognize him in that one.
Aaron's avatar itself that's John photoshopped into Choaniki art is...
Yes.
Oh,
it is glorious, yes.
He's in the headlock, yes, but it's...
Oh, God.
John Lindemann with hair looks like he's wearing his father's rented suit.
Yes. Man. It now is a very good time to be hanging out in our forums because there is a plethora of John Lindemann. I mean, everywhere you look, it's John's face, no matter who's posting.
John arguing with himself, John agreeing with himself.
John trolling himself. So it's kind of like
real
life.
He does that anyway, but there's just more of it now. Seemingly.
My personal favorite is still the one where he's kissing Snow White and nobody's using it.
I'm really
disappointed.
I've seen that. To address the letter from Mikeman just a little bit, I have watched some of the video. I couldn't bear it after about 3 minutes, but
more quality Nintendo channel content.
I don't it's these two guys that they bring out for these videos. They're really long too. The one for Super Metroid, I think it's only the first part and it's like 20 something minutes long. And
so is this like the equivalent that the American Nintendo channel gets? Like the Japanese one, which I can access, obviously has like the Game Center CX episodes
for
Super Metroid. Is the not quite as good, I'm guessing.
I love Game Center. I've seen some of it on YouTube and it's fantastic. No, it is certainly not that. It is literally two like frat boy douchebags playing Super Metroid. And I don't know if I saw the ones with New Super Mario Brothers Wii, but I did see them doing some Wii Fit stuff, and it's brutal. it's so painful because these guys, I mean, the game itself basically isn't interesting enough to support a 25-minute video of someone playing. So they're constantly talking about the game, except they're not really talking about the game. They're basically making, like, really cheap, shitty, PG-rated smack talk at each other while they play Super Metroid. It is such a mismatch of...
I'm going to smack talk you on this single-player game.
Exactly. Oh, it's fucking terrible. It's... Oh, if you haven't watched it, it's kind of worth... I mean, in a Troll 2 way, it's kind of worth watching for a few minutes just to see how misguided... I mean, who is paying for this shit? What are these guys making to do this? They're not funny. They're not authentic in any way. They're not saying anything remotely insightful about the game. And they're ruining a legendarily amazing Super Nintendo game. I mean, what is the point?
I feel like that makes it a little bit better.
Yeah.
James might actually enjoy this.
Yeah, well, it's about a YouTube video of you shitting on the Mona Lisa, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not like they're making fun of Super Metroid. They're trying to say how awesome it is, but they're fucking troglodytes, so they can't make the words to do it.
If only that had been the subject line of the email. Two troglodytes.
I would like to do their job for one episode because I'd be fired by the end of the episode.
Oh yes, you would.
But I yes, feel like indeed. It would be the most awesome way to get fired ever, because I would immediately hone in on like whatever game I could most thoroughly shit on.
You just bitch about the box art the whole time.
They're downloadable titles. They don't have any.
You have to make sure you could pull the emergency slide or whatever and get out of there with some booze before they wash your mouth out for swearing so much.
Oh man, yeah, that video is terrible. Thanks for bringing it to our attention, Mike. Well, it's time to wrap up this episode. So before we go, let me make a few announcements. Deal with some business here. Last call for voting on Retroactive. Our N64 poll is our most voted on poll ever. It is
Ogre
our most
battle.
Participated Retroactive.
Or you're a terrible
so
person.
No, not a surprise to me at all. You see, I mean, as much as we and a lot of other people would say the N64 PSX era is like the hardest to go back to in a lot of ways, you think about the people that probably go way back with this website, like me. We were coming to it to read about the N64's successor.
Right.
The N64 has a special place in our hearts.
Right. I think a lot of guys our age and probably a lot of the people who listen to this show who are also our age, I mean, it is a Nintendo podcast for grown-ups. We're teenagers and preteens and maybe, you know, young children when the N64 was out. And so it is a big part of our lives. I think a lot of people who were older when the N64 came out don't care for it as much, you know. And a lot of the people who are too young to have played the N64 probably hate it.
It's antiquated.
Yeah, but guys our age, I love the N64. We did a whole episode about the N64.
Did a whole episode about the N64.
Yeah. Okay. I shouldn't have brought that up.
Because we never owned one, did we, Mr. Metz? Oh, wait, I own 40 N64 games. 40 games, you bastard!
James, maybe you should do your own N64 episode.
Yeah, but can you really count Gex as a game?
I'm not counting Gex.
Gex is a fine game. Don't make fun of
it. No,
it is
dude,
a fine
dude,
game.
Dude, go back and play Gex right now. It is not
well,
a fine game.
Well, no, I don't
game.
Want to do that.
It is actually terrifyingly terrible. Like, he falls through platforms constantly.
All right.
But, you know, just giving some context. 40 games. 40.
Of course, we are on Facebook. We have getting close to 150 people on Facebook, which I'm very happy about, but that is a small percentage of our listeners. So I would love to see that number go way up. Let's shoot for 1,000. Can we get 1,000 people on Facebook? I'm posting stuff there every couple of days. We have people, there's discussions, people throwing in ideas for the show. It's a lot of fun. You really should check it out. You can see pictures of us at PAX East doing the live panel and a bunch of other stupid shit. Anyway, the address is facebook.com/radiofreenintendo. That's all one word. Really, check it out. We're on iTunes. If you're not subscribed yet, well, you are. But if you haven't written a review yet, and you haven't, you should go do that. We would really appreciate it. Of course, there's a new episode of Radio Trivia. Well, it's a week old, and that's why we're going to spoil one of the games on Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. If you listen to the latest episode with TYP and Zach Miller, you can hear some really pretty music from Muramasa, the Demon Blade, which is rumored to be coming to the digital platforms. Interesting. And of course, it's over now, but I do have to congratulate James and his co-host Carly on the excellent live edition of Radio Trivia.
We didn't ruin it! Yay!
It was a lot of fun. It brought back a lot of great memories for me, and I think everybody there had a really good time with it, too. Congrats to Rimmer for winning that Metroid prize pack. Can't say I'm surprised. Rimmer's always been good at Radio Trivia.
The prizes have been mailed, so they will be arriving relatively short order.
Nice.
Got a long way to go, haven't they, though?
They are going to pull a John Smith on this trip, so gotta give them some time.
Well, it was a great time, and James, thanks to you and Carly for pulling that off, and I hope it's not the last time. Finally, the email address to our show, to this podcast, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would love it if you would send us an email. All right, guys, thanks very much. We'll see you next time. All right, this week we've got impressions of Donkey Kong Country Returns from Aaron. You know you love the Crazy Ape, so be sure to check out Aaron's impressions. God.
Love for the Big Ape.
Sometimes it's just easier to just fucking read it.
Just don't. Don't. It's a trap. We also have Pedro's review of Disney Guilty Party, in which he reviews the Clue-inspired party game and comes away very impressed. You can see his review to find out why this is one of the best party games for Nintendo in a long time.
That game seems really funny, actually. If I had a family to play family games with, I would seriously consider it.
I want children!
Yes, I want children and a wife.
This sounds bad. Greg, save us.
I just feel like shooting myself all of a sudden.
Well, so it's a typical now playing.
Yeah.
God. All right, that's it. Check out all this great original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Bang.
The email address to our show, to this podcast, is rfn@NintendoWorldReport.com. We would love it if you would send us an email with your questions, thoughts, ideas, comments, complaints, whatever. Funny links, porn, you know.
No, don't do that. We get enough of that already.
Speaking of porn, hopefully John will be back with us next week.
Yeah, speaking of porn, John Lindemann.
Yes. Joe Aniki. Okay, thanks very much, everybody. We will see you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Worst conclusion ever.
Really? Mr. 103?
I don't think At least
so.
I know how to end an episode. At least I can end it.
Yeah, that was a tragedy, not a conclusion.
That was like galaxies colliding into each other level of cataclysm.
Look, there's a difference between conclusion and like that, which had no structure whatsoever. You can't conclude the unconcludable.
Yes, there's a difference between hosting an episode and not hosting an episode.
Yeah, I still haven't hosted since Radio Trivia Live doesn't count.
It should.
I'll go to my grave to defend that.